Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson. This is broadcast number 250. That's 1/4 of 1,000. Broadcast number 250 being recorded here from a beautiful golf course in the little community called Wamberal in the Central Coast near Gosford, about an hour north of Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, planet Earth. This is today and the time is now. It's about 9:30 in the morning. Sun's coming. The wind just came up. Heaps of birds. I'm back in my beloved Australia. Been back for about a week and a half. This show is going to be sort of a report from down under, looking at some very important events or processes going on. Partly the beautiful bird songs, over 20 different birds that I've seen just probably today, which is really, really, really cool, and each of their beautiful calls and sounds. And I'm sitting in a small little grove of Casuarina equisetifolia trees, the exact same tree that I know so well from here in Australia called she oaks, that I also was living really close to a giant forest of them on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I'm also going to be talking about the ongoing amazing volcanic eruptions going on there, as well as some of the environmental and ecological issues with which people of one heart who are awake and aware and who care are actually extraordinarily concerned about in the world of today. I'd like to thank my friend Robert Hogenbaum and my beautiful friends at the Buddhist Meditation Center, where I've been staying for the past few days. It's been really, really nice. I'm going to be leaving on Sunday to head south. I'm going to stop off at the William Rickett Sanctuary in Melbourne to work on recording a film and some video there with Paul Bennett, who's the director. This is a, to me, one of the coolest things done by the white man in this whole country. It's an installation in a bird sanctuary up on a mountain about an hour and a half southeast of Melbourne called the Dandenongs, where William Ricketts, back in the 1960s, fell in love with the indigenous people and spent lots of time for off and on for 30 years living with the Pitjantjatjara and Aranda people of the Central Desert. And he decided on to become a sculptor so that he could create lasting images of the true spiritual beauty and power of the indigenous people of this land, to be a testament to white Australia, to who these people really are. What really blew me away a couple of years ago is when I learned that every face you see on the sculptures there are the faces of real people that he knew, and that he carved the bust of each person in their presence in the Central Desert, and then went back to Melbourne, created the statues, took the full-size statue to the Central Desert so that the people could see it, and then if they approved it, brought it back and installed it in the William Rickett Sanctuary. I love this area. It's called the Central Coast. This is kind of like the center of whale dreaming country, where I first connected with Darkin Jung whale dreaming elder Gabby Duncan about 3 years ago. And I'm hoping to do another interview with him one of these days. But Geong, the humpback whale, are starting to pass through now on their way north for the winter. I'm on a golf course now, so I'm actually being attacked by various forms of noise. There's people on the little lawnmower-like thing coming up behind me now, and then there's been some golfers. And these are like you can tell these golfers aren't really very good, because I see a ball go into the water here about several times. If I'm here for a couple hours, I'll see about three balls go into this lake, and then they come into the little stream behind me here. So they're not keeping the balls on the fairways or the putting greens. But they're all sort of like elderly, you know, people that are out, good on them for having a good time out in the beautiful sunshine. And I like golf courses, even though they're probably heavily sprayed with Roundup and other kinds of chemicals and stuff like that. They're usually really peaceful places if you don't come in the daytime. Golf courses at night are really cool. You hear there's heaps of birds. You can hear them along with the lawnmower. Now Now I've got two kinds of noise attack, the lawnmower thing that does the putting greens, and then a guy with a gasoline-powered blower on his back over there blowing off the sidewalk. People just have no conception of noise pollution. But the birds in this area are so amazing. And this is a partial list of all the ones I've seen and heard. Most of just this morning, but in the past couple of days, I've seen all of these. White cockatoos, galahs, rosellas, lorikeets. All four of those are types of parrots. Magpies, butcher birds, bower birds, mynas, herons, currawongs, pelicans, doves, plovers, ducks, willy wagtail, or seagulls, sparrows, and my very favorite one of all, the kookaburras. And he does, in fact, sit in the old gum tree because I saw him. But the one most close to me, like when I first came here to my little spot this morning, there was one that sits on the country club sign just about 3 meters from me. So we accidentally scared him off. But usually you can get really close to him. And I haven't seen very many marsupials yet, except for some wallabies. There's the blower again. I think I'm going to go down closer to the lagoon and get away from all this noise. Now I've moved down to the maybe 200 or 300 meters further down the golf course, closer to the lagoon. There's a bit of traffic noise here, but it's relatively quiet. I'm sitting on a very soft mat or a carpet of she-oak needles, which is very, very, very soft and mushy. I'm sitting near some little fingers of water, which I think is the innermost recesses of the Wamboro Lagoon, which I've never actually looked at an aerial photograph of it, but it's quite complex and quite large. Usually I go out, and I'm lucky enough to have a nice mountain bike to ride here, too. I can ride the bicycle down to the parking lot at the lagoon and walk about a kilometer out to the rock shelf and the tide pools, where I've spent a lot of time over the past few years. And it was where I encountered this cool little octopus twice, where the first time I accidentally stuck my hand out and touched his tentacle by accident. And then a few months later, I was in the same rock pool, and I stuck my arm out, not even thinking about the octopus, and his little tentacle came out and touched me. It was like he remembered me. It was one of my coolest encounters with fellow beings of the animal kingdom. But so I just saw a family of maybe about a dozen ducks. They kind of moved away from me whenever I came into their little sacred area here. But anyway, it's so nice to be back in Australia. I can't tell you how much I'm loving it. And being around all the birds and the parrots and just the wide openness of everything. And as much as I love Madame Pele and the volcanoes and everything, I'm glad to not be walking on lava all the time, because it really tears up your shoes. And you get used to it, but like everywhere you go there on the Big Island, at least in the area where I was in Pahoa, it's all, I mean, there, you know, sure there's soil underneath the grass and stuff, but there's pieces of lava sticking up everywhere. I mean, what do you expect from living on the largest and most active volcano in the world? So that brings me to one of the main things I wanted to talk about on the show, is the ongoing volcanic activity that is just so, I mean, to me, it's so novel and freaky to be around it. I've visited quite a few volcanoes in my life, and I visited White Island, New Zealand's only active volcano, which is an island about an hour and a half northeast of Whakatane in the Bay of Plenty. And Ruapehu is not dormant, although I haven't ever seen it actually erupt. And I lived on close to the base of Rukapian, or what the Europeans call Villarrica, near Pucón, Chile, in 2006. They say that's the third most active volcano in the world, with Kilauea, there on Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island of Hawaiki, being the most active. But, you know, I've sort of covered all this before, but about a month ago, we went up to volcanoes and were able to see the lava spurting up from the lava lake down inside the Haleakala crater, which is down within the Kilauea caldera. Saw that, and then just a few days later, the floor of the Pu'uo'o crater, which is about 10 miles from there, it collapsed almost simultaneously with the collapse of the floor of Haleakala. So what happened was you had two volcanic cones that were about 1,000 meters deep that both emptied themselves of magma relatively quickly. Now I've seen everything. What we're hearing now, it's a blower. It's just like a giant blower that people walk around with to blow a parking lot, only it's so big that it's actually being pulled as a trailer behind a giant lawnmower, and it's got a giant duct blowing out the back, and the dude's just driving along, blowing off the sidewalks and shit. I've never, ever seen something like this before. What the fuck are they going to think of next? It's unbelievable. There it goes again. None of this ridiculous bullshit would be possible if dumbasses weren't willing to do it as their job. If they couldn't find anybody to do it, it wouldn't happen. And about 3 days after both of these lava reservoirs collapsed and the lava just disappeared underground, then we had the giant 6.9 quake that happened while I was making juice in my apartment. Then that really shook. Oh my God, that was major, and it was the psychological aftershocks are even greater than the physical ones, because you just don't know what to expect next, what the implications of it might be, but you really felt like something broke loose down inside the earth. Then, a few days after that, you had the fissures started opening down at Leilani Estates, which is now up to about 24, and it's starting to not only just fountain up like 50 meters high in several places, and also two different rivers of lava are flowing into the ocean, but also it's starting to form lava ponds. So it looks like this is going to be the creation of a major new volcanic complex that might even have one or more pretty serious size cones. I mean, with the way things are going, soon you're going to see robots out playing golf. I mean, isn't that a logical extension of the way things are going? We've already got automated mining sites in Australia. Like, I don't know how many there would be now, but even 3 years ago, there was like three run by Rio Tinto and with Komatsu technology. I'm not going to be surprised to see robotic golfers. But the volcanoes... I really want to thank my friend Mick Calbert, the videographer, for his brilliant aerial photography that he does an overflight every day, and it's his footage that you see on the news and stuff. And really interestingly, in one of his videos from, I think it was from the 22nd or 23rd of May, at the 1:30 mark in the lower right-hand corner, clearly, I'm not making this up, I'm not even reaching, clearly, plain as day, clear as a bell, is an image of a platypus being formed by the lava. It's maybe 100 or 200 meters across. It's got a bill, it's got the eyes, it's got its body, it's got a front leg, two front legs, each of which has about four or five little fingers on it. It's clear that Pele made a platypus out of lava. And I don't know how many people would recognize that other than me, but she already seemed to be doing what I asked her to do, to put on a little show for me before I left. But, oh my God, I mean, I guess this is a little show for her, but it's been a major ongoing thing for the people of the Big Island. I mean, I think a lot of the people, a big difference I noticed is that the news seems to sensationalize everything as they do, for whatever merit or dollar value that might have. But the attitude purveyed by the media is far more exaggerated and edgy than the attitude of the people there on the Big Island. The people there are, even people that are evacuating their houses and stuff, they're still pretty low-key and matter-of-fact about it. I mean, no one can be happy about losing their home and not ever being able to go back, because where they lived is now just a field of lava. And that's happened to, like, quite a few dozen people. But with all compassion and sympathy for them, what can someone expect from living on the most active volcano in the world and the biggest volcano, which is Mauna Loa? They say, the USGS scientists being the they, that Mauna Loa is the largest volcano on the earth when you look at how big it is from coming up down on the bottom of the ocean, which it reaches 4,000 meters into the air above the ocean and another 5,000 meters below the ocean. But its mass makes up a full half of the entire Big Island, and the rest of it would be four or five other volcanoes like Mauna Kea, Kilauea, Hualapai, and then the new one that's coming up down south of Kilauea, Lo'ihi. I don't know how long that's going to be till it comes over the surface, but it's just brewing. This is right over what this major mantle plume of magma coming up from really, really, really deep down in the earth. But the main problem for people there on the Big Island is not really the lava itself, but it's the gaseous emissions, the sulfur dioxide and other gases coming out. And then now they've noticed that the burning of a lot of the plant and organic material is actually creating a lot of methane, which is then itself igniting and burning with a blue flame. I saw that in a video last night. And then also where you've got what they call VOG, volcanic smog, which is pretty much a constant problem there, mainly in the Kona area because it's downwind of Kilauea where it comes out. You never hear about VOG in any Hawaiian tourism information. But in addition to the VOG and a lot of the sulfur dioxide emissions, as well as the particulate matter of the ash falling from the sort of billowing eruptions up there at Kilauea, from where the water is going in and the size of the crater collapsing in, you've also got this stuff called lase, which I think is lava haze, from where the lava enters the ocean. It puts out a billowing white cloud of steam, but it's also got hydrochloric acid and microscopic particles of volcanic glass. So you don't want to be breathing that shit. And it reminds me of the longest word in the English language, not counting if you write out the name of chemical compounds and not counting place names, but the longest scientific word in the English language is pneumono ultramicroscopic silico volcano coniosis, which is a rare lung disease that you get from inhaling microscopic particles of volcanic dust. So people on the Big Island may in fact be susceptible to coming down with pneumono ultramicroscopic silico volcano coniosis. We'll have to come up with some remedies for that. The longest non-scientific word in English is one, I don't know if I've ever said it on the show before, it's called flossinosinahilipilification. I'll spell it, that's FLOCCINAUSINIHILIPILIFICATION, flossinosinahilipilification. It's a term from British auctioneering from the 1800s that means the act of estimating something to be worthless. So how funny is that? That you've got the longest word in English means the act of estimating something to be worthless. So if you had something up for an auction and you said, like, well, you know, this thing here, you can just have it free because it's worth nothing, you just flossinosinahilipilificated it. I've been flossinosinahilipilificated myself a few times by certain people whose names I won't mention, declaring that I am worthless. A worthless bastard. Anyway, it's just so special to have been there to witness. Well, I didn't actually see a lava flow in person because I wasn't able to get close enough to it, but I smelled it. the smell of that sulfur dioxide smell, oh my God, it sent a shockwave through me in the middle of the night. But mainly because of Mick's brilliant aerial footage. And also, I asked him if he was able to get some high-quality audio recordings without the helicopter noise, and he said yes. So that's, I mean, you know, this is a really cool contact. I'm sure I'll be able to interview him in person when I go back to Hawaii, and maybe a Skype interview as soon as things settle down on the Big Island, but they don't seem to be. It's just been going full blast for 3 weeks. It doesn't seem to be letting up. He said that it looks like a new vent is opening halfway between the Leilani-based fissure system and the ocean, and that a hot spot was forming up on Chain of Craters Road, which is about halfway up from where it's flowing into the ocean to Kilauea, but sort of away from where all the activity is happening now. I mean, when you think about it, it's a volcano and it's honeycombed with lava tubes all underneath, a lot of which may be mapped and understood, but a lot of it may not be. And these systems are constantly changing, subject to magma and lava flow and tectonic motion and gravitational disruption and collapse of lava tubes, and just, I mean, it's a growing living being, and she's given birth to new land, which is a very, very, very sacred process. And it's been my honor to be there during that time, and my heart goes out to everyone who's lost their home, and I hope everybody stays safe and sound and has clean air to breathe. But you are living on the most active volcano in the world. And then there's the whole possibility of the geophysical warfare of some kind may be involved from the Puna Geothermal Venture plant there that's just literally right in the center of all the activity that's happening now, which is just kind of bizarre when you think about it. I mean, this is the East Rift Zone, and that's why they put it there. But, you know, when you realize that the kind of drilling technology they use for fracking, it can go straight down for miles, many, many, many thousands of feet, but it doesn't have to go straight down. It can actually curve sideways and go over like at right angles. They can go down and then over at a right angle and go like a mile sideways, you know, and if with all that being guided by earth-penetrating tomography and microwave and radar and all kind of sensing technology that can help them know where they're going. Who knows what they've been doing there? It could be that this eruption has a geophysical engineering dimension to it, but at this point there's no way to know for sure. But Terry Lilly, my great friend who I didn't get to meet this time, but it just wasn't meant to be, because he invited me over there to stay with him on his research boat in Kauai. And if I had gone at the time I was supposed to go, I would have got washed out to sea along with his boat when that giant rainstorm hit about a month ago. They were paying attention and saw it coming, and so he went on his boat the night before and got all his computers and cameras and hard drives and stuff and took it out and flew it over to Oahu to be safe. And if he hadn't, his boat got washed out to sea and he never saw it again. All he saw was a videotape that got washed up on the shore. So I was supposed to have been staying on that boat. I would have ended up in Oahu too. So I didn't make it to Kauai because it turned into a battle zone after that record rainfall of over 50 inches fell, that's 1,500 millimeters, fell in less than 24 hours on an island that's accustomed to getting massive rain. But Terry said that in all his 30 years of living there, he had never seen a storm system come and stall on the mountain there for 24 hours, dumping 50 inches of rain on one side of the island, and on the other side, just where the Pacific Missile Range facility operated by the U.S. Army and Air Force happens to be, with the largest microwave transmitter installation on the planet, didn't even dump a drop of rain there. The moron working here at the golf course with the stupid blower on his back just came over right by the putting green, blowing that stupid fucking thing, and it blew a giant cloud of dust right across where all these people were standing there playing golf, like he just didn't even think or look or see or care. I hate this shit. These stupid blowers, the idiots with the yellow shirts on that just do it. Pardon my indignation. Terry Lilly. Bless his beautiful Mr. Limpet heart. He just had a very shocking experience a few days ago. He said that, well, his home, his boat got destroyed in the storm. And so since then, he's been camping out in various places in his van and recording his, doing his dives and his video and stuff like that. And he had a camping permit. I'm not sure how all the legal stuff goes for camping on Kauai. I know a lot of people camp up in the mountains there. And I think you just pay a fee and it's legal. But apparently he got a two-month camping permit for to camp anywhere on Kauai. But it didn't start till the next day. And so that one day before it started, even though he'd already paid for it and had it, he was camping out and these officials of some kind, I'm not sure if they were police or county people or they weren't military, but they were some kind of bureaucratic thug assholes came and started harassing him, and they didn't beat him up and they didn't arrest him, but they took a lot of his gear. They took his camping gear, they took his scuba gear, his diving gear. They didn't take his cameras or his hard drives because I don't think they saw him, but he was extraordinarily distressed by this. And then he went the next day and he took all his hard drives and stuff and hid it in a secret location where nobody can find it. So that was a really good idea. But they've been harassing him because he's the eyes and ears of everybody else to see not only the beauty and power of nature there on Kauai, who many say is the jewel of Hawaii. It's the oldest of all the Hawaiian islands. But not only does he show the beautiful images of nature, of the corals and the fish and the whales and dolphins and also the ducks and the lagoons and the bodies of water and the beaches and the rainbows and everything beautiful there, who those are his family that he really loves and the indigenous people. Not only does he show all that, but he also brutally shows the impact of the U.S. Navy and all the military presence there, and also the rampant development and exposing the corruption in all the local, state, and federal level government and their interaction with the banking cartel and the politicians and the military, and how they're just doing stupid thing after stupid thing there to turn wetlands into hotels and making beaches that get washed out to sea and destroying the habitats of critically endangered animals like the ducks, and pointing out how legally the military is supposed to enforce the Endangered Species Act, but really the opposite is the case. They're the ones who are most seriously violating it, and all kinds of legal stuff about with the naval war games there, RIMPAC coming up, and his work a couple of years ago exposed, pretty much showed unequivocally that the destruction of all the corals is being caused not by the evil bogey of climate change, but by the microwave weapons systems technologies used by the Navy there at the PMRF, which is one of the largest microwave transmitter installations on the planet. So because of, he's like a thorn in the side to all these people. And he said he's had his arm broken before and had his life threatened. And, but yet he can sit down and meet with all these military people. So they have a degree of respect for him, or at least that's how that's one of the faces they give him. But, you know, who knows who sent these people to harass him? So he's involved in a whole lot of legal stuff now, including with the FBI. And, you know, because what they did to him was completely illegal. Completely. But he's lucky that he's still alive. You know, but now he said that he's just like trying to find somewhere to stay, and I'm sure there's a lot of people there that would give him a place to stay, but I think there's a part of him that doesn't want to be around people, and I can really understand that. I mean, Terry, you don't want to put yourself at risk by avoiding people too much, because there are a lot of nice people there that want to help you, but I know fully what you mean about feeling a lot more comfortable around the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above, because they have a lot more of that thing called love than most people do, regardless of what they say. By their fruits you shall know them. So anyway, send a lot of love for Terry Lilly. I call him Mr. Limpet. He's done an amazing amount of work on behalf of Ohana Moana and all of our family of life in the ocean. you might be able to hear a little of this very magical sound of the wind blowing through the casuarina needles now that the blowers and all the machines have stopped. You can hear the voice of some golfers in the background there. I don't hear any birds right now. This is the first day in about a week. We've had a week of just the most beautiful autumn weather that you can think of, and there's quite a few trees around here that are showing some European traditional autumn red, orange, and gold colors. Although most of your native vegetation in Australia doesn't really change color during the different seasons. And I've been lucky enough to ride the bicycle down to the Wambo Lagoon. I'm going to go here after I edit my show and upload it for Jules Stanley at UCY-TV. I'm going to go and gather some go-to colas out from the Wambo wetland area to get going for my beautiful friends, Judy and Trevor Turnbull, who I met the other day. There's a very sacred mountain about an hour and a half from here called Mount Yango that's sort of like the Uluru to the East Coast indigenous people. And I haven't visited there yet, but Gabby Duncan, the Darkinjung whale dreaming elder, has been saying that he would take me there. Later in May, they do have I wonder if it might even be this weekend. They might be having their gathering up there. How interesting. But on this last trip to Australia last year, I was able to visit a bunch of really cool places, and two really powerful places that I had never been to before. The Warrumbungles in extreme northwestern New South Wales to visit Malcolm Harley and the Comet Astronomers, and Kata, or Kangaroo Island, which I had never visited before in all of my 18 years. And on that same trip, I went back to Yunbanoon, or Magnetic Island. Then I visited Darwin for the first time since 2010, saw my beautiful friends Peter Chumley and Ursula and Greeny and a bunch of really cool people there, and Gregor Aquari and Uther Nimby. And then I got to go to Uluru and Kathajuta for the first time since 2004. And that was really, really, really special. But speaking of Yunbanoon or Magnetic Island, my beautiful friend Uncle Arthur Johnson passed away last week, and he's the elder of the Walguru Kaba people, who, if you've seen my website, you'll see a picture of him holding a wooden dolphin that I helped him to paint. And I met him 3 years ago when Rick and Nell let me stay at their place, and Uncle Arthur happened to be there, and I had made a painted rock for him, and I gave it to him, and he fell in love with it and asked if he could come over so I could show him how to paint. So almost every day for the next 3 weeks, he came over and we painted together, sitting outside beneath the beautiful casuarina trees and the sunshine, and I really felt the ancestors smiling on us big time. It was a very, very special thing, and he was already getting a little frail. He was probably about 77, 78 years old, but I just learned last week that he passed away because he'd been in and out of the hospital. But I'm definitely carrying on the tradition of painting dolphins and turtles, and I hope to see him again on his journey. And I'd also like to honor the spirit of Uncle Bob Randall, who was one of the custodians of Uluru, who, if you've seen my Facebook profile, that rock is a picture of the painted rock I made for him after I saw him in a John Pilger documentary called Utopia. I really loved his spirit and what he had to say. It's like he was kind of like the Dalai Lama of the indigenous Australians and a spokesperson for indigenous people everywhere. And I was going to go and give him this rock, and he passed away before I could get there. So last year I was able to meet his widow, Barbara Randall, and interview her for my show. And also at Uluru, at Kathajuta, I met Keisha Randall, his favorite granddaughter, as well as Pamela Taylor, an awesome artist who was painting The Seven Sisters Dreaming. And I want to thank Harold Thomas, the Aranda artist, who gave me permission to paint the Sister of the Rainbow Serpent in Alice Springs. He also designed the Aboriginal flag in 1970 and is a very highly accomplished landscape painter himself. And I'm also hoping to make it to Adnamanta country in the Flinders Ranges and see Uncle Ron Coulthard, who's been a vigorous opponent of all the uranium mining there, maybe Uncle Ken McKenzie, the Christian folk singer, and maybe Dean and Lizzie Rashid, who used to run the resort at Wilpena Pound, and Doug Sprigg at Arkaroola. And I have a cosmic question to leave on, because I've been staying at a Buddhist meditation center and learning a lot about Buddhism, and also doing some interviews with my friend Robert Hogenbaum about the Gurdjieff work. And these are sort of two quite different spiritual psychologies or philosophies or approaches to being here now in a way that's not purely materialistic, as so much of our society is. But they're sort of different schools of thought or arguments or perspectives on the nature of reality and what is an illusion versus what is a delusion. And it seems to me that when it really comes down to it, what works for me is that whatever seems real at the time actually is, for all practical purposes, real. And that pretty much covers all the bases, but, you know, it doesn't try to boil anything down to this or that and to say that this is real and that's not, or that's an illusion but this is a delusion. So if it seems real to you at that moment in time, it may as well be. But, you know, I guess that's the difference between an illusion and a delusion, is that the illusion is you're aware that it may be a mere epiphenomenon of your mental neural activity, or it may be like a mirage, an optical illusion or something like that, something that you, it appears to be different than what it actually is. But you know that it, or at least you're asking the question about how real it is. So you're not gonna, if you see a giant pink elephant blocking your path, but you know it's an illusion, you're not necessarily gonna get out of its way. But if you were deluded, that means you believe, or you're not critically thinking or examining about your perception, so you believe what could easily be not just a sense perception, but an illusory one. So if you dodge the pink elephant and run out into traffic and get hit and killed because you dodged the imaginary pink elephant, then that was a delusion with harmful consequences. So I guess a lot of delusion and dementia in the human psyche is benign, but I would say the vast majority, if not all, of our astronomical quantity of destructive behaviors across the full spectrum of everything we do, that is almost exclusively driven by delusion and dementia. And that's something I've talked about on many shows, and I will talk about many more times, but I won't talk anymore now, because silence is golden. By their fruits you shall know them. And I always give honor to all the kingdoms of life, especially the kingdom of the plants, because they have roots and trunks and leaves and flowers and pistils and stamens and bark and xylem and phloem tubes and camphor and pollen and nectar and fruits and nuts and seeds and berries and grains and vegetables and cones and needles and stomata and phytochemicals and many, many blessings to all the kingdoms of life. And my family of Kaitiakis wants to say hello. Teddy, Wally, Ruby Ann, Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huckleberry, and their distant cousins, Snoocha and Freddie. Oh, Waffy Ops, we want to thank everybody out there. We loved seeing Madame Pele in action, and we love hearing the Kookaburras. I got some really good video footage and photographs of Huckleberry, because this is Huckleberry's first trip to Australia. Huckleberry, are you having a good time? Oh, Waffy Ops, I can't believe it. I can't tell you how beautiful it is here. And yes, we went yesterday to another new place. I was inspired to go there because my great friend Adam Godwin said that he and his new partner Nikki were going to move there. It's called Nora Head, N-O-R-A-H, Head, about an hour north of here. And it's got a beautiful giant rocky outcropping with a lighthouse, but it used to be called Bungaree Norja, or Noraj. So that, I think that was the people from there are called the Awabakal. The Awabakal people. And I'm trying to learn more about it, but this is sort of a headland sticking out, kind of like Dirrawong, Evans Head in New South Wales, further to the north, which is the sacred dreaming site for the Goanna dreaming ancestor who I painted in my mural there. Aloha Kuakati from the land down under. where women glow and men chunder. Do you hear, the thunder? You better run. You better take cover. Yeah. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Good day. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.